Okay, if we can begin, we have a quorum present. We've got only three bills on the agenda, but all lengthy bills this morning, and a variety of people in the audience. Just a reminder to everybody, no demonstrations, applause, whatever. I know committee members often violate that, so if you could please watch yourselves. We're going to start with Senator Pappas, Senate File 1191, which is the omnibus retirement / pension bill. So, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I just have a few brief overview comments that I want to make, and then Mr. Martin will talk a little more specifically about the fiscal sheet, the fiscal note. Pensions have become an important topic discussed by legislative bodies and the public around the country. The dot-com bust in the stock market in 2000 and the Great Recession that began in 2008 precipitated serious financial issues for public and private pension plans. Before we start discussing this bill, I want to give members a framework for this topic. Minnesota began establishing pension plans in 1885. In 1959, the legislature created the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. It was formed as a bicameral, bipartisan commission to provide a thoughtful approach to pensions. I've served in this body for 29 years, and I've served on the Pension Commission for 7 years. And all these years and prior years, the commission has tried to fashion a sensible and affordable pension plan for public employees. The goal has been to attract, retain, and fairly compensate people for their public service. We have a special obligation to do this to the 30,000 police and fire safety employees affected by pensions because they're not covered by Social Security. For all practical purposes, the pensions, disability, and survivor benefits these public safety employees receive are what this legislature provides, and it's a big responsibility. We also owe our best efforts to the other 276,000 active public employees and 171,000 retirees, disabilitants, and survivors. Public employment counts for over 10% of the state's entire workforce. But if there's one point I would like members to understand about pensions, it's a very important number, 1.6%. 1.6% is the total amount of state and local spending that goes to fund pensions in Minnesota. The importance of this number is this. The national average spending on pensions is 2.9%. Minnesota spends less than half as much on pensions as the average state. Minnesota ranks in the lowest 10 states for spending on pensions. This 1.6% metric makes us stand out nationally. Because we've managed our pension obligations so well, our state's creditworthiness is enhanced. Former MMB Commissioner Tom Hansen has said that the 2010 pension reforms were received with amazement on Wall Street and helped our credit rating. We're not California, we're not Illinois, we're not New Jersey or any other state where we hear in the news that pensions are a problem. Some states are now faced with spending 5 to 6% of their budgets on pensions. If we were spending that amount on pensions, I would concede we have a serious problem. However, we do not have a pension crisis that calls for drastic action. We do have a situation, however, that needs to be addressed. And like all problems, the sooner we address them, the easier and quicker we'll find the solution, and that's why we're here today. One major reason we do not have a pension crisis is that the Pension Commission has always required employees to pay their fair share. For general employees, that means they pay half the cost of their pensions. For public safety employees, we expect them to pay 40% of the cost of their pensions. This policy has helped avoid the plight of other states. In addition, in 1971, the legislature enacted PELRA, the Public Employees Labor Relations Act, which, among other things, took pensions off the bargaining table. That policy has also helped control Minnesota's pension costs. Minnesota also has another huge asset for controlling the cost of pensions. Minnesota ranks 45th in the nation in the cost for providing fire service. We pay $70 per person in Minnesota compared to the national average of $137 per person. The reason for that is that nearly 90% of our firefighters are volunteers. This saves the state $360 million a year or $1 million a day. We owe these men and women who volunteer a debt of gratitude. We also must keep our promises to them. In the bill before you, we're trying to fix the number of pension issues we face, but We're addressing the PERA, police and fire, and the state highway patrol plans. We do this by cutting benefits and raising contributions. In the PERA police and fire plan, we're cutting $450 million in benefits. We're raising employee contributions by $10 million a year and by $14 million a year for employers. In total, we save the plan $64 million a year. Members, this has been done with the agreement from all the police and fire groups and the PERA Board of Trustees. In total, the police and fire members and retirees are paying 80% of the cost of these changes. We're addressing the judges' plan and fixing that by that funding by cutting benefits and raising contributions. We're also helping to stabilize the St. Paul and Duluth teachers' plans. We're providing a COLA of 1% of these plans. That is 1% less than TRA and MSRS COLAs. MSRS is the state retirement system, and TRA is the teacher retirement system. We're raising St. Paul and Duluth teachers' contributions to 7.5% of salary. That's the same as TRA. In fact, the St. Paul School District will be paying nearly 10.5%, 3% higher than other school districts with their supplement. We're also leveling the benefits between all teachers in the state. In this bill, we're increasing state aid to St. Paul by $7 million a year and $6 million a year for Duluth. This aid is necessary to put these plans on course for full funding in 25 years. If the bill passes and our assumptions hold true, these plans will be 100% funded in 25 years. The legislature has provided help like this before. In 1980, we provided aid to the 47 local police and fire pension funds around the state. We aided the MRF system, that's the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund, in 1978. In 1985, we provided TRA with $30 million a year that helped all cities except Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. We've also provided help again for MRF and Minneapolis teachers when their funds were declining. In this bill, we helped Duluth and St. Paul for a combined $30 million starting in the second year. The cost to consolidate these plans with TRA are estimated to be three times as large, or $40 million a year. But there have been concerns expressed on the long-time viability of the Duluth and the St. Paul plans. So I have an amendment I'm going to author that will require merger studies for both plans. We do have language in the bill to fully study what this will cost, and the study will be due January 6, 2014. Both Duluth and St. Paul have been in existence for over 100 years, and both plans have a strong history of being responsible and well-run. Duluth has had some demographic challenges in recent years, and St. Paul has a history of being underfunded, yet it has had excellent investment returns, which exceeded the SBI for the last 10 years, with low administrative costs and COLAs that have been lower than TRAs. These plans have not been mismanaged. They simply need help. In St. Paul's case, a strong argument could be made that the state should have required higher employer contributions from 1978 to 1996. Had the legislature done so, the St. Paul teachers would have had an additional $250 million in assets. In summary, I believe this bill will continue to support these pension systems, which affect nearly 450,000 Minnesotans. Members, these are good, well-thought-out measures. And the fiscal note shows that we're cutting benefits in the aggregate and that we are reducing benefits. And Mr. Martin from the Director of the Pension Commission is going to just briefly tell you about the pension note. Tell you about the fiscal note.
Mr. Martin.
Members, I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. The bill that you have before you deals with
Mr. Martin. Folks can't approach members at the committee table. If you want to approach somebody, do so through a page or through another staff person, but you can't approach people directly at the committee table. Sorry, Mr. Martin.
The bill that you have before you, the Omnibus Pension Bill 2, relates to six of our public employee pension plans and has state funding implications for four of them. Two with direct general fund appropriations and two with fiscal impact to agency budgets. And I'll focus primarily on those. The two that have a state general fund impact are the additional aid amounts for the Duluth Teachers Pension Plan. This is in Article 5 of the bill, and for the St. Paul Teachers Plan, also Article 5. The bill provides for annual additional state contributions of $7 million for St. Paul teachers and $6 million for the Duluth teachers. In addition, the bill increases member contributions for both plans and increases school district contributions as part of the total package. The two plans that have agency budget impact are the judges plan and the state patrol plan. Judges plan is in Article 6 of the bill. In this case, there's a 1% contribution increase by judges that's triggered by a salary increase for the judicial branch, and a 2% employer contribution increase, and that's the agency budget impact. For the state patrol plan, which is Article 1 of the bill, there's a member contribution increase of 2% provided for in the bill, and a 3% employer contribution increase, and that's the agency budget impact there. The state patrol plan covers law enforcement and firefighter, law enforcement in several state departments, but principally the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Natural Resources. The plan covers the State Patrol, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the state game wardens, also some individuals at corrections, the fugitive apprehension officers, and the insurance fraud officers at Commerce. Members, Mr. Nauman can actually go through the numbers of the fiscal impact, but this is where the primary fiscal impact is in the bill. I'm happy to answer any other questions about the substance of the bill or the funding issues that are before you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. And I should indicate to members, I think I had said earlier that we were having some difficulty with monies appropriated, and that just relates to the bottom line monies we have. And as I indicated, that this bill would be the significant appropriation, although there may or may not be some concerns as we as the transportation bill, the omnibus transportation finance bill, is pursued. So folks should understand that relative to St. Paul and Duluth, the implementation will be the second year of the biennium, with the continuation of the money subsequent to that. I think as Senator Pappas had originally hoped it would be for both years of the biennium. We'll see where things go as this bill progresses, see what happens, obviously, in the conference committee process with the House. But to make sure that we follow where we are in terms of this committee, we have an amendment that will deal with that. So having laid that foundation, Mr. Nauman, did you want to comment on the amendment and what we're going to do relative to our fiscal note?
Did you want to pass out the A2 amendment?
Yeah. Let's have the A2 amendment distributed.
Mr. Chair and members, perhaps it would be helpful for me to there's a lot of numbers on the front page of the fiscal note, and so fiscal staff has prepared a slimmed down spreadsheet, and I believe it's in your packet. Yes, Senator Robertson, that's the one.
Sure. Mr. Chair, that's the one that I have questions on.
So I'll endeavor to maybe unpack some of these beforehand. So the amendment that's coming around, I'll first work through the spreadsheet. There's direct appropriations that are required in the bill, and the amendment will deal with that in the first 12 lines or so of the amendment. Appropriations required out of the general fund on the state patrol side for a general fund appropriation of $95,000. Trunk Highway Fund appropriation of $546,000, and then another appropriation of $8,000. The bill, as it stands in front of you, as was previously discussed, requires statutory appropriations for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund at $7 million each year, and for Duluth at $6 million a year. The amendment that's coming around would make a change to the fiscal 14 numbers and delay the $13 million total for the two teachers' funds. So if you mentally eliminate the $13 million appropriations in fiscal 14, for both the St. Paul and the teachers' retirement funds, then you would have a spreadsheet that represents what's being discussed in the amendment.
Okay. Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'm not sure who can answer this. Maybe the gentleman from the campaign. Pension Commission. Disparity in the public safety area versus total teachers. Can you expound on that a little bit more? Not knowing totally here and had a chance to look at the total bill, but is that due to the expansion of the St. Paul teachers in Duluth then? Or is it that those particular pensions were in a little deeper trouble?
Mr. Martin.
Senator, Mr. Chair, the Duluth teachers and the St. Paul teachers plan have greater funding difficulties. They're smaller pension plans. They were very adversely hit by the 2008 recession.
Okay. So the question, I guess not the question, but the statement is public safety thing doesn't seem to be too. Is it fair to say they're not in too bad a shape here then in comparison? Obviously, in comparison-wise, they're not.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair. Senator, in addition to the, there are benefit changes in the state patrol plan that are fairly significant. The St. Paul teachers and Duluth teachers made a number of changes in their benefit plan in 2010 and 2011. There are some changes here, but the state patrol benefit reductions, longer vesting, imposition of a overall benefit cap, some other changes in their post-retirement adjustment rate have a significant reduction in the liability of the pension plan, and that's in part why you're seeing the difference in the numbers. The benefit reductions that are in the state patrol plan are more significant actuarially for the state patrol plan than the benefit reductions in the two teacher plans.
But Mr. Martin, if I'm not mistaken, that none of this involves benefit increases, does it?
Does they have a COLA in the state for patrol plan?
Yeah,
their COLA. The MSRS COLA.
Ultimately, I think.
Limited.
But it's 2%. The MSRS.
It's 1%, I believe.
Yeah.
Should we have Bergstrom come up here?
Yeah.
Mr. Bergstrom from MSRS, I think State Patrol is under MSRS, should be here to just talk about the State Patrol. There are some benefit increases in terms of a COLA.
COLAs, but
consider that a benefit increase.
But only the COLA, nothing.
Only the COLA.
The traditional kind of COLA.
Well, that's not exactly true.
Okay.
Because there's an equalizing of benefits in the teacher plans.
Okay.
But let's talk about the State Patrol first.
Right. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. In the State Patrol plan, we're actually reducing liabilities by about $33 million. We're reducing the cost of living adjustments. That plan has a very heavy weight of retirees. We're increasing the early retirement penalties and asking for an employee and employer contribution. So we're really taking a different approach of kind of balancing the plan out.
And Mr. Bergstrom, does that reflect just the reality that law enforcement officers will retire at an earlier age than other people in the workforce?
Mr. Chair, this still would allow them to retire with full benefits at 55. If they go before that, we're going to increase the penalty so it's not as subsidized as it was before. there are no improvements for the State Patrol in this bill.
Right.
Okay. Senator Engelbertson.
Chair, as it should be, by the way. It should be retiring earlier. I thought I'd just put that in there. No,
that's a serious
question. A serious question. Due to the fact that I know police and fire as well as State Patrol are actually participating in a more meaningful fashion now. They're going longer before they retire. They're participating more. So my question is, are the teachers involved in this plan doing the same thing? Are they raising their retirement dates?
Would you
but
like?
I already know they're higher. I already know that the retirement age is higher for them. But are they participating in the same fashion?
think it's Duluth and St. Paul.
Are you talking about TRA, or are you talking about St. Paul and Duluth?
St. Paul and Duluth.
Do you want to know overall what
the teachers actually,
are doing?
Actually, the ones we're talking about today is St. Paul Duluth. But actually, overall, TERA, are we paying into those as well, or is that school districts most generally that are paying into those?
We are paying, the state is paying into TERA as well.
And that would be another question I would have, too, and I know we're running them all together here, but you have Duluth and St. Paul. Their school districts are paying in their share as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yes, good.
Okay. So maybe as we move along, you might have more specific
questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, Senator Pappas moves the A2 amendment. Senator Peterson, did...
Mr. Chair, you can go ahead. I have a question relating to your initial comments about this this bill. Can I ask that to you
sure.
now? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think you referenced the transportation finance bill, and so if I heard you correctly, you're saying that the funding for this bill, this Senate File 1191, would be reduced or raised based on the cost of the transportation finance omnibus bill. Is that accurate?
Well, Senator Peterson, I only mentioned that because that would be potentially another larger amount left out there. As I've indicated, we've tried to track these freestanding bills against where we are with our budget numbers. And the transportation omnibus bill is the one bill that has not passed to the floor yet. And I'm not going to ask Senator Dibble to get into the bill right now, but he's been reworking the bill over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, we're not going to pass a bill to the floor out of this committee unless we know that it balances against revenues available. I don't know where the transport. I don't serve on transportation, and so I don't presume to know what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. Or I think the bill's in the tax committee now, and I can't presume to know what the tax committee will do with the bill. So that's why I mentioned transportation. It's not tied to this bill, but I'm trying to make sure that we follow what revenues are available.
So to follow up on that, Mr. Chair, the cost of this bill will remain the cost of this bill as it passes out of this committee?
Well, Senator Peterson, I guess I can't speak for what would happen on the floor of the Senate. I would trust and hope it would not change, but... That's for the full body to determine.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, to keep within the chairman's budget, the A2 amendment does not start the appropriations till the second year of the biennium, so that we are not paying for the changes, the additional aid to St. Paul and Duluth in the first year. However, I will, interest of full disclosure, the House does start the payments in the first year, so the House does have a larger appropriation. So if that passes the House floor, it's on the House floor this afternoon, then they would have to be reconciled in some way with a global target.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, can you talk about why St. Paul and Duluth, I mean, all the retirement plans hit the recession at the same time? For example, Anoka Hennepin is, you know, such a large district. That's not on there. The other districts around the state. Why is it that these two are in the shape they're in?
Yeah, I actually asked Mr. Doan from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund to come forward, and we had just talked about that before the meeting started. A lot of it had to do with there were no employer contributions between 1978 and 1994, so the school district was not required to pay their employer share, and that created an unfunded situation. Come forward. More interesting to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, and the rest of the plans around the state, they were making, even though they weren't required, they were making?
They were required to make contributions. The all the other school districts were required. It's kind of a mystery to us why the St. Paul School District wasn't required. And it's the reason that they have an additional surcharge on their payments, so they're 9-10% instead of 6.5, or so we're raising it to 7.5 because of all those years of not paying into the plan.
Mr.
Doan can provide it in more detail.
Okay, and Duluth, you're saying, was in the same situation?
Well, no. We'll talk about Duluth second. So let's talk about St. Paul first.
So, Mr. Doan, if you could identify yourself. I should mention, if members will be polite, Mr. Doan is a former Massachusetts senator but more remarkably, a former Republican senator from Massachusetts. So, Mr. Doan.
You'll know by his accent.
Chair? Senator Ingridson?
What would be remarkable about that?
There aren't a lot of Republican state senators in Massachusetts, I don't believe. But Mr. Doan can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator, the situation, as best as I've been able to research it, was that
Mr. Doan, if you could just, after my introduction, just introduce yourself formally.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Doan. I have the privilege of serving as the executive director of the St. Paul Teacher Retirement System. They were once a client of mine back when I was in the investment business, and I retired, and they had lost their director and asked me to step in. So that's why I have the privilege of serving here in St. Paul, and I enjoy it very much. And I apologize for this cold. I think I must have got it while I was in California last week on a meeting. Certainly didn't get it here in Minnesota. St. Paul Teachers System, as Senator Pappas mentioned, started in 1909. And for the first 55 or so years of its existence, it operated on a pay-as-you-go system. So contributions were made, and they were paid out to the beneficiaries, $1 in, $1 out, so forth. In the late 50s, it was determined that it was important to begin putting money aside for establishing some trust fund that could cover this if the situation developed where the income wasn't sufficient to meet the outgo. So they began, but it was not until 1959. In 1978, the legislature mandated that the system adopt a second sort of system within the St. Paul School retirement system. Originally, it was called the basic plan, and it went to a coordinated plan. And the coordinated plan was to include Social Security for those new teachers. And the basic plan members were given the opportunity, if they desired, to go into the coordinated plan. So in 1978, about a fifth of the membership were coordinated members. But the legislature at that point said that the employer school district did not have to continue to make these additional contributions that were being put aside to cover the past 55 years or so of underfundedness for any of the coordinated members. They only needed to maintain it for the basic plan members. And at the time, there weren't that many coordinated members, so maybe it was seemed kind of innocuous. But gradually, of course, with the requirement that every new person become a coordinated member, today all of our members are basically coordinated members. So from 1978 until 1994 or so, the additional employer contribution, which was specifically designed to address the unfunded liability, was terminated for St. Paul and for only St. Paul. No other school system had this impact. And I've gone back and tried to calculate what that amount of money has meant. And in terms of actual contributions, it was about $35 million, $37 million. But that period of time in the investment arena from 1980, let's say, to 1995 was a particularly buoyant time for the stock market and for the investment arena in general. And taking what the system earned annually and applying it to the monies that would have been otherwise available, that total comes to closer to $265 million. So if we had that $265 million today added on to what we have, we would be clearly on the road to full funding within a reasonable time period. It was that period that was critical in this funding system that was missed. And this is a way to address that unfortunate sort of development. And our actuary has projected that for maintaining a sufficient funding level, we need to raise about $16 million or so more per year than we've been able to raise. We can only go back to the employer and the employees so much. As Senator Pappas said, we're already going back to the employer for an additional 1%, which will raise them to over 10.5%, about 10.5%, which is 300 basis points, so 3% more than any other system pays in the state. The employees will be paying 7.5%, which will equal them with what the TRA employees are paying. But looking at the cost of what they are contributing into their own retirement, normally, called the normal cost, and normally that would be about 50% or so of that future benefit for those current employees. The amount of money that they, the active employees are currently paying amounts to about 95% of that. So, again, it's an overwhelming amount of burden that is being placed on the employees. So we can't go really back to the employer. We can't go back to the employee any more than we're already doing with this bill. That only leaves sort of two other options. One is to reduce benefits, which we have selectively done with this bill in some respects. And hopefully appreciate the portfolio at the 8% rate of return. And we are making every effort to not only ensure it's 8% or better, but with less volatility, which is the measures that the board is currently putting into place. So you have three ways to address the system: raise contributions, improve investment return, or cut benefits. And we are attacking all of those fronts, I can assure you. The one sort of component is the one other contributing element into our system, other than employees and employers historically, has been the state. And we're trying to make up with this bill what was, in essence, a result of some action back in the 70s that really put the system behind the eight ball. And as my predecessor says, who still has serves on our board and has all the institutional history, this system would have been broke 30 years ago if it hadn't been for the outstanding investment returns that have been generated. So it has, and as Brian Rice has said, was sort of the little engine that could. The system has made it work. We are at a point, however, where in order to resolve the final issues, we do need this assistance from the state. And we've, of the $17 million that we needed, the system with cuts and increased contributions is making up about 11 million of that need. And we're asking for the state to make up the other $7 million.
If anybody wants more details, I do have a full presentation on this situation with St. Paul here. Maybe we could have the page pass them out.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
A couple more questions. During that time where they weren't paying the employer's share, were there also significant payouts during the boom time?
Well, essence, the history of Chairman, Senator, the history of St. Paul's payouts have been far less than other systems in the state. It has not been an over-generous payout. To be honest, the contribution, the COLAs that were have been given at that point in time, I don't have that history with me, but the history, at least at the time when they went to originally, or at least for a long period in the 90s, they paid what was then called a 13th check. And so if the system had had a good investment return, they would share some of that return. If there hadn't been, then they wouldn't share that. Then they went to giving people a COLA. And there were periods in the 1990s when everything was roaring and COLAs were given, but St. Paul's COLA was always far less than any COLA given by other systems in the state. And then it went to a system more recently where it provided for an annual set COLA. It went to, I believe, 2% for much of the 90s, and then in 2008 or 9. It terminated the COLA for a two-year period, so no COLA was given. And then with the legislation that the chairman referenced earlier in 2010, it went back to a 1% COLA, and that's where we currently stand.
Mr. Chair, so a couple more questions. Has there been consideration about merging St. Paul teachers? And I've never served on pensions, so forgive me for asking so many questions, but I just, given how much time I've spent on education and not having served on pensions, I just want to understand what's really happening here. So,
Mr. Chairman, That's the 13A amendment. It is asking both Duluth and St. Paul to participate with TRA in a merger study to look at what the cost will be and, you know, a timeline. And but it's very expensive because the both systems need to come in at a higher funding level. So I mentioned in my opening comments that it would be something like, I forgot what I said now, $30 or $40 million a year to pay for the merger.
Mr. Chair, finally, so then I guess that raises the question, depending on the study, we may want to revisit this later, depending on the results of the study, decisions that are made today, and I suppose we could do that.
Mr. Chairman, what we are doing today it can only help with a merger, because with a merger, you will need to equalize benefits. So we are doing some equalization of benefits with TRA for both St. Paul and Duluth by increasing the multiplier. We are not equalizing the COLAs because that's very, very expensive, and the Pension Commission is going to look at our COLA policy over the interim. The past philosophy has been that you want to preserve the integrity of the pensioners' pension fund. So if you have inflation, you want a COLA that's going to at least match inflation. And because we haven't been having inflation, that COLA, even at 2%, has been too much. And so a lot of the funds have cut back to 1%, flat COLAs for a few years, and now we're just looking at minor COLAs. So we will not be seeing COLAs in the 5 and 6% range.
Final question.
Senator Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pappas, given that these plans are in this situation, and we're asking the state to put in pretty sizable ongoing contributions, does it seem appropriate to have the COLA be in law rather than be something that, you know, the funds, it would depend on how the funds were doing?
No, Mr. Chairman, it is in law.
Is that appropriate given the state putting in this kind of money right now?
There are two different issues. Issue is we need the state contribution, whether they stay as independent funds or they merge. In fact, the state contribution through merger would be higher.
Right.
The COLA is a separate issue, mm-hmm. and the Pension Commission is going to look at our COLA policy. There has been discussion about giving the funds some flexibility to be able to adjust their COLA. So that is in discussion.
Okay. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, I've not served on pensions either, and so the question I relates kind of back to those local communities. We're referencing just using Duluth and St. Paul as an example. Are those local communities helping bail out these pensions as well?
Mr. Chairman, you mean the local school districts?
Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. Their contribution is being raised from 6.5% to 7.5% of payroll.
So it's about 1%. And so relating back to the $13 million, do you have an idea of what that is in terms of percentage that the broader Minnesotans are contributing to that effort compared to the local level? More or less?
I have no idea. Maybe someone else can do the math. I don't know.
Is it more?
Are you talking about what all the other school districts are contributing to their
Just the money coming from the – Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, just the money coming from the general fund, the $13 million. I think most Minnesotans would understand that's coming from them rather than the local school districts that were involved in the decision-making relating to these pensions. Is that a greater percentage or higher amount, or is it a lower amount than what the locals are contributing to this fix?
I understand this question.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator, if you take the $7 million for St. Paul, that would work out to be 2.73% of pay. The current payroll for the St. Paul Teachers Plan is $257 million, so $7 million as against 257 is about 2.73%.
So the state is, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, so the state is pitching in almost 3% and the local school district is paying about 1%?
Senator, the bill provides for a 1% contribution increase by the school district, and the state funding is a flat dollar amount, $7 million, It currently is 2.73%. It would go down over time as payrolls go up. Systems.
So,
I don't,
Mr.
I don't know
Chair.
If that's being clear.
Yeah,
I don't know if I understand your question. I don't know if Mr. Martin's answering it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Peterson. Senator Pappas, what I'm trying to get at is certainly the local school districts made decisions relating to these pensions, and they're not performing. And so now we're taking $13 million from the general fund, is that accurate, in the second year, to contribute to these funds that are not coming from the local school district?
Over and above what the local school districts are paying, yes.
Okay, so what's... Is that a greater percentage, the fix coming from all of Minnesota? Is that a greater percentage than what's coming from the local school district?
It seems to me you would have to take the payroll of all school districts in the state, other than Minneapolis and Duluth, and divide that by $13 million to get that figure. And I don't know what the payroll is for all the school districts in the state. The state, however, is also contributing to all the school districts in the state, I think at a level of $30 million a year, and also is contributing more for the Minneapolis School District at $20 million a year or something. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's necessarily the school district's, St. Paul School District's fault here, because if the state says to you, oh, you know, everything's going so well, you don't have to pay toward your pension plan, that's really our responsibility, where we did not require them to pay toward the coordinated members. It wasn't kind of their choice. It was the state that made that decision.
And members, Senator Ingebrigtsen was next, but members, I forgot to mention when we began discussion of the bill that relative to pensions, there's another pension section that we have heard, and that's judicial pensions, which was contained within Senator Latz's bill, his omnibus finance bill. So we've already heard that discussion, and the monies for the judicial pensions is tracking in Senator Latz's bill. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just please address the fairness question that I have. When St. Paul decided not to be in that, St. Paul teachers decided they weren't going to pay, or if the state of Minnesota decided to do that, that's behind us. I get that. I understand that. But now the St. Paul employer contributions are going to be asked to increase only 1%. Well, the MSR and the state patrol are going anywhere from 2 to 3%. Why only 1%?
The St. Paul is increasing 1% to be the same as TRA, but St. Paul also has a surcharge, surpayment of 3.84%. So the St. Paul School District is paying an additional amount in a sense to make up for not having paid in for that period of 18 years.
Mr. Chairman, is that reflected in here then?
Did I say that?
That other surcharge you talk about?
It's current law.
Mr. Doan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, just to remind that in 2010, St. Paul was before the legislature and asked for an increase at that point, which was granted. So
increase in what?
Increase in contributions for employers and employees. So there was a 1% increase that was built into the system then. That raised the state, employees, the active employees, from 5.5% to 6.5%.
Mm-hmm.
This will take the employees from 6.5% to 7.5% of their payroll, which I mentioned was well above the percentage of their future costs of retirement than other systems would normally pay, and bring them up to about 95% of the normal cost. In other words, their retirement benefits are being paid by themselves, not even counting the employer contribution, not even counting what the invested money will accrue to over the next 25, 35, 40 years and so forth. The school district is going from the current level under this bill will take it to 10.5%, which is 3% higher than any other school district pays within the state of Minnesota. So from the standpoint of the employee's share and the employer's share, there is a significant level of outperformance or outpayment, overpayment, compared to other systems. So they shouldn't be seen as sort of a shortchange of the state or not doing their share. If anything, they are doing in far excess of what other systems are being asked to do totally across the state. The 6.5% that Duluth and St. Paul are currently at, this bill would take it to 7.5% of active employees' contributions, and that would just equal the same level that the state teachers are currently paying. So there's nothing in this bill that doesn't, in essence, demonstrate that we're more than pulling our share. And to address the previous question, we're looking to narrow that funding gap of $17 million, and the system itself is making up almost 65 or so percent of that gap. It's just that remaining piece that we feel as though we've gone back to the employer and we've gone back to the employees far more than would normally be expected. And the balance is that piece that we're asking the state to make up for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then we come to the issue of the 2008 recession, which was kind of insult to injury for these plans. And that really hit Duluth very hard there. And Mr. Stoifel can, or Mr. Johnson can help me if I need it. But they were fully funded, I think, in 2007. It's a small plan with less assets to manage, but they've done a very good job over 100 years. But they have a demographic problem in that they now have 1.5 retirees for every one active member. Mm-hmm. So their school district has lost the charter school kids went into TRA, and the local community college went into TRA, so they lost members that way. So they don't have enough active members. So that's the purpose of the 13A amendment, which is the merger study, is to look at what would be the costs for having Duluth merge into TRA.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I need to go back to my previous question, and I found it here on page 4 in the St. Paul handout here. Is there a handout like this for Duluth by any chance?
Yes, there is. You can pass those out too.
As members, I mean, I think if you're willing to look at that, I think you can see that the local contribution there, if that's accurate, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.4 million then. And then the state's contribution is $7 million. Is that accurate on this page 4?
Well, yes. Except the total amount the total amount is about $10 million from in terms of actions. There's some steps that the system has taken and has already taken that will narrow that gap from 17 to 7. And so they're taking care of $10 million of that, and the balance is being requested from the state.
But Mr. Chair, and those are actions taken in previous legislative
well,
sessions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, in one case it is, in looking at that graph, the step there in terms of actions in process, step 2 there, prior approved contribution increases, that's presently baked into the system but hasn't been realized yet, so that'll be realized over the next 2 years. The other two are steps that the board is taking prospectively to address this shortfall. So for the most part, only the provision about the contribution increase is something that is a result of prior action that is still being realized.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pappas, I mean, I think you probably realize, I mean, there's a great deal of Minnesotans that are very upset about this, and I'm just trying to understand. I'm kind of trying to come up with an answer for them as when they're going to ask me, you know, why are we taking money from the general fund continually to put towards these funds? It seems to be a greater contribution than what the local the local communities that made these decisions are doing. So from your committee standpoint, you're satisfied that the locals have made enough of a contribution towards fixing these?
Senator Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in some ways, St. Paul teachers have paid less because they've had an inferior plan. They haven't had the benefit level that TRA has. And if we, you know, it is a process. If you want to attract good teachers to your community, you need to have a competitive pension plan. And St. Paul has not had the ability to do that. So by slightly increasing benefits, by equalizing benefits with TRA, it puts St. Paul in a more competitive position. In addition, the teachers are going to be paying the same as TRA, so in fairness, they should get the same benefit set. The school district, however, is paying more because of the years of them not having paid into the pension plan. So I think St. Paul School District is definitely stepping up to the plate. But the reality is, if we had not had 2008, the changes we made and continuing problems with the stock market, the changes we made in 2010 could have been adequate. And we did start with some state aid a few years ago of $3.5 million for St. Paul. We are giving state aid, as I mentioned, to TRA. We have been for a number of years for all the teachers' funds. So you could tell your teachers that that the state is contributing to their funds as well, not just to St. Paul and Duluth.
Senator Pierce.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, I mean, there isn't a person in this room or probably in the state that hasn't been affected by 2008, and quite frankly, there's a lot of people a lot smarter than us that think there's another 2008 that's coming, you know, in the not-too-distant future. And so in your committee, did you have any discussions about maybe just holding back on the COLA increase until the study was done?
Mr. Chairman, Duluth initially wanted a 2% COLA, and I asked them to do a 1% COLA instead. TRA is doing a 2% COLA, but may reconsider that next year. And we are going to be looking at COLA policy in general. Like I said, our pension principles do say that we should try to maintain the integrity of the pensioners' fund. But under consideration is not compounding COLAs, for example. So you would be like a 13th check. If you had the money, you would do a COLA. If you didn't have the money, you would not do a COLA. That does differ from our policies in the past. And, pensioners feel like the state has made a contract with them. And so it's very delicate. We have been sued in the past by people who say, you made a contract with us when we've limited COLAs, and you're not living up to your contract. So we do take that responsibility very seriously. So it is a very kind of delicate thing about people who they plan on getting a certain level of pensions, and they make retirement plans based on that. And if we change the assumptions or we change the rules of the game, you have a lot of really upset people, and they call their legislator.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, there's a lot of upset people on both sides of this issue, and I think we all know they call their legislator, certainly. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if we could take the A2 amendment.
Okay. So we have the A2 amendment in front of us. I should indicate to members, for this meeting and future meetings, we're in the conference committee process, as everybody knows, and so we've had several people, I think, at least this morning, Senator Westrom, Senator Laurie, Senator Thomasoni, Senator Saxhog, who've been asked that we call them back for votes as they proceed. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about the Section 11 addition on the A2 amendment, maybe to Mr. Martin or Senate Fiscal.
Mr. Nauman.
Just the use of the trunk highway funds and the highway user tax distribution funds. Are these normal uses of those funds for state highway patrol pensions, and are these in roughly proportion to how those funds get used?
Mr. Martin?
I think Mr. Nauman.
Or Mr. Nauman, do you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, it's my understanding that this is a standard practice. This is for the State Highway Patrol plan, so I think it would be a normal, appropriate use of these funds. If Mr. Martin disagrees, he can state that.
Mr. Martin?
Yes. Senator, for the State Patrol, the contribution load is allocated within the department. But I have never spent any real time looking at that allocation. These are the numbers that MMB provided when asked what is the normal allocation of the total employer contribution load.
Thanks. That's good enough. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Pappas, are you moving the A2 amendment?
Moving the A2 amendment.
Are further questions from the committee? All right. Okay, I'm told by Ms. Kaplan that members are arriving. Cernino, I couldn't.
Mr. Chairman, while we're waiting, maybe we could pass up the 13A amendment too.
Certainly. We could have some discussion on that while members are arriving.
While we're waiting, Mr. Chair.
Sir, we're having did you have a question on the?
No, I just thought while we're waiting, I had another question for Senator Pappas, but I can.
Okay, well, sure, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, you had mentioned that within this change that there are increases in benefits to have the St. Paul teachers more closely reflect the other plans, and one of them, you know, we talked about the COLA. What was the other benefits that were increased?
It's called the multiplier. And if you look at it's similar for Duluth. If you look at the St. Paul handout, on page 4, in the middle section, number 4, increased multiplier.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, what does that mean?
We'll let Mr. Martin explain. I understand it, but I can't explain it.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. Pension benefits in Minnesota are calculated as a percentage of a person's high five average salary. And that multiplier, that percentage, is the benefit accrual rate or the multiplier. What is being proposed here is to parallel what is in the statewide teacher's plan for service in the future after a designated date. The benefit accrual rate will be 1.9% of pay rather than 1.7%. And in the case of St. Paul teachers, it's for service after 2014.
So the rationale for that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, is that teachers' benefits their payments are increasing, their contributions are increasing, and to be parallel to TRA, so we are equalizing benefits with TRA as well.
Okay. Senator Pappas, we've had the 13A amendment distributed.
The 13A amendment is actually upon request of the governor. When I talked to him about pension issues, he was very interested, and maybe it goes back to when he was state auditor, with merging the smaller plans into the larger plans. And we've been doing that gradually with the police and fire plans on a voluntary basis. And for different reasons, Duluth and St. Paul may be at different stages of urgency, but it's a good idea to look at this in general. So we put together this amendment to do the actuary work and do the study on the consolidation costs.
Okay. All right. We have, I'm sorry, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Sorry, do we know what the cost of this is, Mr. Chair? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the cost is going to be borne by the TRA and by their actuary will do the work and by if anything needs to come from Duluth or St. Paul.
Thank
you. There's no cost to the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bott.
It's me.
Oh, that's why you didn't. Senator Seidman.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, could you or have someone explain the language on 119 to 123 where it talks about the Duluth Teachers Fund and merging the St. Paul Fund in a manner comparable to that provided to the former employees of the former Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund upon consolidation? What happened in that consolidation that's unique to name it in the report?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is like comfort language for the employees that when the Minneapolis Teachers Fund was merged into TRA, they also absorbed the employees. There's actually plenty of work that has to be done, and there's plenty of expertise that is needed in terms of understanding the differences in the plans. So the intention by TRA, and they have no problem with this, in fact, they said they might have a Duluth satellite office, if it was Duluth, would be to have the employees considered for hiring by the bigger fund. You know, and that worked. Some, you know, there were retirements. There was some people went and worked other places, and they were easily able to absorb more employees.
Okay, we've got the A2 amendment in front of us. I don't know. Folks are coming in and out. Is Senator Westrom? All right, we have the A2 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion on the A2 amendment? If not, all is in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the 13A amendment.
All right. Then we have the 13A amendment. Senator Pappas, you've discussed that. If there's further questions on the 13A amendment, if not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Further discussion on the bill or further amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I have the A3 amendment.
Okay, if we can have that distributed.
And Mr. Chair, while that's being distributed, City Attorney Susan Siegel is going to come to the table. Minneapolis City Attorney Susan Siegel is going to come to the table to help us understand the issue that we're presenting. The A3 amendment is the language of a bill that was introduced by Senator Hayden. It was not heard in front of the Pensions Commission. I'm not sure why, but it's an important issue.
Why don't we have Mr. Schechner from the Met Council also join us?
Okay, that's fine. So the issue, Mr. Chair, is that the short version is, and then I'll have City Attorney Siegel explain in slightly more detail. It has to do with the MRF consolidation with PIRA that occurred a couple of years ago. And as a part of that consolidation agreement, the employers who represented MRF beneficiaries agreed to pay ongoing to the Bureau Fund to deal with the ending shortfall. The shortfall was so dramatic that it was MRF on its own was anticipated to completely default.
Excuse me, can the page give us copies up here, please? Oh, okay. Great, thank you.
Sometime between 2016 and 2022. Minneapolis has been being forced to pay the portion of those funds for the Met Council employees that had been placed into an account a number of years prior as a matter of courtesy and administrative function. Met Council contends that by having done that, Minneapolis picked up the responsibility for those Met Council employees on an ongoing basis. Minneapolis disagrees and doesn't feel like they agreed to at that time to pick up the future actuarial liabilities or, you know, manage the risk of those previously Met Council employees who are beneficiaries of MRF. And if you look at the existing language of the MRF consolidation, you know, if you look in at line 1.24, you know, that paragraph E specifically calls out the responsibilities of all of the employers to provide those supplemental contributions. Met Council is listed, as are the others, and the others are paying their fair share. Likewise, paragraph H, same thing. And so this dispute amounts to about $450,000 or so per year that City of Minneapolis picks up on behalf of the Met Council, which we think is not fair and not the right thing. And so this language clarifies that Met Council needs to pick up its responsibility and not foist it onto the City of Minneapolis on an ongoing basis.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, this proposal, I believe, was introduced, and it was on the agenda for the Pension Commission, and then for some reason, I'm sorry, I don't recall, it was not taken up. I think we were hopeful that the parties would resolve the dispute. But so this has not been reviewed by the Pension Commission.
Ms. Siegel, did you want to offer some testimony, if you might identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. I'm Susan Siegel, and I'm the city attorney for Minneapolis. And the city and Met Council have engaged in a number of discussions, but they've led no place. And as you know, with the 2010 merger of MRF into PARA, the legislation set out the MRF employers who are supposed to contribute supplemental contributions. And this merger legislation wasn't just because of market changes. There were structural problems with MRF, and I would direct people back to Larry Martin's memo to the Legislative Commission on Pensions that supported the 2010 merger legislation. Back in 2002, before this was known, the City of Minneapolis did a favor to MRF and to the Met Council by agreeing that Met Council could pay a lump sum into the MRF account and that Minneapolis would then take over the administrative responsibilities. That agreement specifically said in it, an assumption of these liabilities by the city is in the public interest as it reduces administrative costs for the council and MRF without a material increase in administrative costs to the city. The city never intended to become a risk manager for the Met Council. The amount of money that they paid in as a lump sum back in 2002 was $1.37 million. Met Council has advised us that they don't believe that was ever even credited to the City of Minneapolis account at MRF. I don't know if we can unwind that at this point or not. So it's entirely possible that Minneapolis has, in fact, been paying for MRF, Met Council MRF employees up through 2010 without even having this lump sum credited to us. In terms of present value cost of this, if the City of Minneapolis is required to pay for the Met Council's MRF employees, depending on what discount rate you use, it's over $6 million. We're not in the risk management business. We think it's unfair. It was never the intent. The city never benefited from this. We were just trying to help out fellow governmental entities in a way that actually should be encouraged by the state legislature rather than later punished. We are not Citibank, and we are not in the risk management business.
Okay. Mr. Shetnan?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and it is never a good time for me to come up and have to oppose something that our chair, Senator Dibble, who has been such a good friend to the council, to oppose one of his proposals here. But we believe that this amendment is unnecessary. We believe that What it actually does is take apart an agreed upon agreement between intergovernmental agreement between the Met Council, MRF at the time, which is now PARA, and the City of Minneapolis. And when we made this agreement, it was more than the $1.3 million that Ms. Siegel references. We also transferred an additional $470,000 of funds that were sitting in our retirement account to that fund. And when we made the agreement, it was clear that this agreement was meant to be final. And in our intergovernmental agreement, just to make that point even further, it says that when the payment was made, that MRF agrees that upon receipt of the council's payments in accordance with the section, that the MRF shall credit the council's payment to the city's account with MRF, record a consolidation of the council's MRF account with the city's MRF account, which was the $1.8 million, consolidates assets held in the council's account with the city's assets, dissolve the council's account. And when we say dissolve the council's account, when Ms. Siegel goes back and mentions the language that is currently in the amendment that says in under line point 1.24 that says the council is listed here, that was an error. That the council should never have been listed because our account with MRF should have been dissolved by MRF at that time. And to go back and have this conversation we think is unfair. We think that it is completely unnecessary, and it is a cost to the rest of the region. We ask ourselves that if there was an issue with the MRF account or with PARA, if they would have gone gangbusters and the recession wouldn't have hit, and if the funds would have overperformed, we would have never expected the City of Minneapolis or MRF or PARA to give us the benefit of that moving forward. And as also Ms. Siegel mentions, that we do believe that there are internal issues with how this was accredited to the City of Minneapolis. We are the ones who are asking for that to be figured out. The City of Minneapolis doesn't know that at this point, and we think that it is very unnecessary for us to be at this point when there are questions about whether or not those funds were actually credited to the city. And we think that is for the city to figure out. And again, we mentioned, we talked with them earlier this session. We talked about looking into this, and this the next step we find is ourselves sitting here in front of the Finance Committee having this conversation. And again, it is all with complete respect to Senator Dibble, but we do not support this amendment. I can go into this further if you would like, but I would just like to add one last thing. In our intergovernmental agreement, it says that no recourse against the council can be taken. MRF, the language says, MRF further agrees that upon receipt of the council's payments in accordance with the section, which was the $1.8 million, MRF agrees that it will look only to the city, meaning the City of Minneapolis, for any of the council's MRF obligations as defined in that section. It will have no further recourse of any kind against the council for the council's MRF obligations as defined earlier in the agreement. I think that speaks very loudly, and this amendment should not move forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm also sorry to say this, but this issue really should have been dealt with by the Pension Commission. I apologize to Senator Dibble, and I think Senator Hayden was the author, that it wasn't dealt with. And I don't think it's fair to have the Finance Committee members expected to understand this rather complex issue here at the last minute when we have other pressing bills in front of us.
Sure. Senator Dibble.
Well, first let me allow City Attorney Siegel to respond, and then I have a suggestion.
Ms. Siegel.
Mr. Chair, the response is that the agreement related to MRF, and that statute no longer exists, and that the legislature's actions in 2010 are just fundamentally different. We have tried to find out, and Mary Vanek, I know, is here, and they may or may not have files that explain what happened in the past. We're happy to let the past be the past. The Met Council can get back its $1.37 million minus whatever, you know, should have been contributed on their behalf, unravel it, and move forward. I mean, this is a fundamentally different, and we're sorry for bringing this at this late moment here, but But, you know, it's good for Met Council, but it shouldn't be, sorry, City of Minneapolis and City of Minneapolis taxpayers, you lose.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's time, and I just want to state for the record to the Met Council that I'm not dropping this issue. This is $470,000 per year that the City of Minneapolis picks up for Met Council employees that it never agreed to do. This is not a trifling matter, and they're hiding behind a 2002 agreement that was an administrative agreement only that related to MRF and has no relationship to the 2010 merger. And it is fundamentally unfair, and it is inappropriate for them to fight us on this. Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the A3 amendment, but I would request the Chair of the Pensions Commission to fully hear this matter, you know, if not yet this year, maybe over the interim or as soon as we get back to business next year. We absolutely have to find resolution to this subject. We can't just.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, we will be having interim hearings, and we will definitely, I'll tell Mr. Martin to put that on the list.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Siegel, Mr. Shipman. Okay, further discussions or amendments on Senate File 1191. If not, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 1191 as amended be recommended to pass. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Okay, then we have next Senate File 778, Senator Pappas. Let me announce we have Senator Respill's Senate File 661. It's clear we're not going to get to that bill this morning. We're trying to contact authors of bills proposed for Monday's agenda to determine if we'll put Senator Respill on the agenda first thing Monday morning or if we'll meet later tonight. So that's in turn. So Senator Respill, you might be on the room. I indicate we're going to strike your bill from the agenda this morning. We'll see how things proceed hopefully by the end of the morning. And let you know. Thank you. So, Senator Pappas, we have Senate File 778.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, before we start, could I just ask a question about when did we decide, or you decide, to put this on the agenda?
Yesterday.
It's been on and off the agenda this week. I think it was yesterday we put it on the agenda.
Less than 14 hours ago? I believe we got the notice at about 6:45 last night.
Okay, I thought it was a little bit earlier than that.
I could check for sure.
Well, but,
yes, Mr. Chair.
But it's been on and off the agenda, like I said, this week. So I think there has been notice that we would be hearing it at some point. The expectation was we would be hearing it today.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would beg to differ with that because I don't believe that there was real – any kind of real formal notice that we were doing this. I don't know if you had contacted proponents and opponents about it like it required in the rules, but, you know, there is a 3-day notice, and the spirit of that rule is to at least notify the public and let the public know what we're doing down here, because obviously this is an important bill to people. It's a very contentious bill, and the public deserves to be notified. Now, I can pull up the email about 6:45 okay. Last night is the first time that I was made aware. Yes, there was a TBA. The notice for the meeting itself was posted, but not what we were going to be hearing, and that is part of the requirement.
Well, Senator Fischbach, as you can note by the crowd of people here, a lot of folks had an idea that this bill was going to be heard. And that's why I think, in fairness to what looks to be 100, 150 members of the public, we should proceed with the hearing. I'm not sure, given where the floor calendar might be, how far we'll get. But I think we should begin hearing the bill. Senator Miller?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Miller.
It appears that the folks that are in the audience today are all proponents of the legislation.
Well, actually, Senator Miller, the only people who have requested to testify are all opponents of the legislation, and it looks like there are about 6 or 7 of them. Okay. I don't have any proponents that have asked to testify.
Mr. Chair, I do know I've heard from several constituents on this issue that have some major concerns, and obviously with the time frame, they weren't able to get up here today or submit anything, but...
Well, Senator Miller,
I'll express those concerns verbally.
If there are folks from your district, from the city of Winona, who had intended to come here for the hearing to offer testimony, as I said, my expectation is that I don't think we'll finish. If you can contact them, and happy to hear from them this evening or tomorrow.
Very good. Thank you.
Just let me know if they're driving up from Winona.
I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't think they'll be up here this evening because of the weather, but I'll let them know.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Someone made reference to, or yesterday, had indicated to me that this bill had not been through HHS Budget Division. I just quickly checked, and I didn't see on the website that that has been the case. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that we really should be taking this up in this committee without it having gone through that division. Those are the healthcare budget experts. I know we have Senator Lori chairs that, but he's... One, he's not here right now, and I don't think, I'm looking around, I don't think we have one Republican member on this committee that also serves on the HHS budget division, and this was heard in policy, I heard that in policy, but we very intentionally try to stick mostly to policy questions, not budget questions. Mr. Chair, is the plan, we're going to take some action here, send that back down to HHS budget division, what are we doing?
Well, two comments. First of all, relative to the membership on the division, actually, Senator Lori is the only member of the Finance Committee who is on his division, Democrat or Republican. Second, the divisions are contained within the Finance Committee. So, the rule of the State Senate that a bill has to be heard in division before it's heard in the full Finance Committee. It's the prerogative of the chair. In consultation with the chairs of the division to make that determination. Senator Lori has no objection to the bill being heard in the full committee. So it's going to be heard in the full committee. There are financial aspects to this bill. In fact, I've got some very serious questions about some of the fiscal issues. So we're going to hear the bill. Senator Nino.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that you're not breaking a rule. If I thought you were breaking a rule, I would have made that point. I think you are engaging, if we proceed, we collectively are engaging in a significant breach of protocol and a really bad idea. This Health and Human Services budget is extraordinarily complex. I've served on the budget and or policy committees for HHS. Every year I've served in the legislature. It is an extraordinarily complicated, extraordinarily important piece of the budget, and it is absolutely wrong to be taking up something that will have this kind of impact on HHS services. It may not have a direct fiscal impact as far as making the budget bigger or smaller, but it will absolutely have an impact on the expenditures of that money. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make a motion that we send this down to division.
Okay. Senator Nino, let me respond to your comment about HHS. One of the reasons for the back and forth is I've had Mr. Nauman working, I think he was working upwards to 9:30 last night, relative to the fiscal issues. And we'll have some significant discussion and debate about the fiscal issues relative to this bill. And I think that might reflect some of your concerns and I think answer some of your concerns as discussion proceeds. I don't want to get into that right now, because I want to have Senator Pappas have the opportunity to present her bill, and then we'll discuss the fiscal note with people from the agency. As far as Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, just a bit of history. In the last biennium, the right-to-work bill, which was rightfully resting in the Jobs Committee and should have been heard there, was removed from the Committee of Jurisdiction and dumped in the Judiciary Committee last year. So if there's a history as to jurisdictional fealty, I think the precedent has already been set.
Mr. Chair, just one last comment, if I may.
Senator Newman.
And I was going to make this comment before Senator Latz's comment. My argument isn't about jurisdiction. My argument is about expertise. We have one member on this committee that is a member of the HHS Budget Division. I serve on HHS policy. I did hear this, and we focus on a matter of policy. But my concern is budgetary expertise. The full finance committee here, I would venture to guess most of us serving on this committee don't fully understand the nuances and the implications of the HHS budget intricacies in detail. Clearly, we understand the bigger picture. Mr. Chairman, you control the agenda. I'm not going to make my motion now unless you would like me to make that, but at some point I am going to move that we send this back down to the HHS Budget Division.
Two comments, Senator Nino. First of all, I had Ms. Kaplan just check the progress of this bill because you reflected on expertise of division or other members of the Senate. The bill's been heard in the Human Service Policy Committee, the State and Local Committee, I believe, Senator Pappas, is that correct? It was heard in your committee, and it was heard in Senator Latz's committee. So it's been heard by a significant number of the State Senate. That's one comment. Second comment is, just to understand, you can make the motion to send it down to committee, and then I could, 30 seconds later, bring it back to the full committee. So I'll view that motion as a reflection of your concerns about the lack of a fuller discussion. But just so you understand procedurally, it might be a distinction without a difference. Senator Nino.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. My point is that I'm making a point. And there's no question this bill's been heard through a number of committees. It's just not been heard by the one committee that actually has the expertise and the knowledge about the budget that this potentially would be impacting. And that is my concern. Now, my point here is not to try to make a procedural move to try and – I don't even know what the vote count would be in that committee. It's just a matter of principle that something that has this significant impact, we're not talking about, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. I mean, we're talking about services to thousands of Minnesotans and more than likely probably reducing some of the services as a result of if this were to become law. And the budget division is the place that really has the expertise to talk about those real-life implications. And Mr. Chair, procedurally, if I win the vote, you pull it out, I might win it again, and we could ping-pong this thing back and forth. But if I lose the vote, then at least I've had my opportunity to try to do the right thing.
Okay. Well, why don't we, in courtesy to the author, let's allow Senator Pappas to at least explain what we're talking about. And then if members want to make motions of whatever sort, let's entertain the motions at that point. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before Senator Pappas begins, I just wanted to follow up a little bit on what Senator Fischbach said about the timing. Want to be very politely critical of the timing, Mr. Chairman, in that we were on the floor until late afternoon, early evening. And I will confirm that I don't have my computer here, but after we left the floor, go home, get something to eat, then check email, and my email, which was the first that I knew of this very controversial bill coming forward, came into my computer at about 7:15 last night. And, Mr. Chairman, I try, I'm not always successful, but I do try to look at bills before they come to this committee because I perceive this to be a very important committee. And I don't sit on any other committee that this bill has been heard in front of, so this is the first look I've had at it. And from my standpoint, Mr. Chairman, the notice that we received is really not adequate and not fair for both the proponents and the opponents of this bill. So my criticism, Mr. Chairman, is the lack of notice on a bill that we all, I think, can agree on is quite controversial. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Sir Newman, let me just offer a comment, and I'd like to turn over to Senator Pappas. The notice requirement is what, the 3-day requirement? And as I understand, I was just consulting with Mr. Bodden, who's taking a look. But there's flexibility and ambiguity relative to the rule. I don't disagree that this bill has significant controversy, no question. There's also no question that the expectation was the bill was going to be heard today. No question the official notice was, to the letter of the rule, late. But we've scheduled lots of bills in this committee and every other committee I've served on in the Senate and every other committee that I'm aware of where bills are placed on the agenda officially within that notice limitation. In this instance, a decision was made to do that because, one, most people expected this bill would be heard this morning. Two, the expectation, and we had another bill scheduled on the agenda, and my best guess was we wouldn't finish this bill this morning, which we're not going to do, because I think session starts at 11 o'clock unless that's changing, Senator Pappas. Three, I knew that there would be a significant number of people, both opponents, and as I said, the only people who've asked to put on the list for testimony are opponents, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. But I knew that there'd be a significant number of people who'd be coming this morning, who expected to come this morning, and that certainly is represented by the folks in this room. The combination of all that, I felt it was appropriate to schedule the bill within in that 3-day limit. Now, all of us are here, the senators. Senator Nino raises another question, which is this an appropriate place of jurisdiction to have further debate on the issue? But certainly that's a determination internal to us. And if there are significant other folks, whether organized or unorganized, who wish to appear in opposition, it's clear there'll be opportunity because we won't finish the bill this morning. Again, Senator Pappas, unless you're the president, do you have any sense of what's going on with the floor?
Mr. Chairman, the motion was that we go back to at 11 o'clock today.
So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could suggest that I give my opening comments, that we maybe we add the technical amendments and that we hear from the testifiers, and then the technical amendments could be engrossed before we come back so it's a little easier to understand because we have quite a few technical amendments and we've also deleted some provisions to sum down the cost of the bill. And then have people take a chance to look at the bill before we come back.
Well, and Senator Pappas, that's exactly what I've been trying to suggest, is that we allow you to go ahead. Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just taking some notes as you were speaking here because I like others, have received a significant amount of messages from residents that honestly believe that this is a violation. And I think what I heard you say is that as I was writing here, that according to the letter of the rule, this notice is late. But what was the second part of that? What's your reasoning for taking it up today?
I thought you were taking notes.
I was. That's why I missed that part. I'm trying to come up with an answer. I mean, I don't want to just – I could say, well, according to the letter of the rule, this notice is late.
Okay.
Please contact Senator Cohen's office.
Are you ready to take notes again?
I am.
All right. Okay. Senator Peterson, what I indicated was that the years I've been here, I think it's true of any of us, no matter how junior or senior, and most of us are senior members, that bills have always been scheduled on a not a late basis, but bills have always been scheduled fairly soon before the hearing, within the rule. And that's been discretionary with the chairs of the committees. So that's number one. Number two, the expectation was that we would never come close to finishing the bill this morning, and that clearly is the case. And three, that because in this instance, as opposed to a bill just being because this bill had clearly people expected it to be heard this morning, I felt there was some expectation relative to that. And again, I said that that was represented by the large number of people here. Let me just and the rule was just handed to me, which I didn't have in front of me. What the rule says, 12.3, to the extent practical. So, Senator Peterson, I want you to note that word. If you're still taking notes, so to the extent practical, a committee, subcommittee, division shall announce each meeting of the public at least 3 calendar days before convening. To the extent practical, and then it says that if the 3-day notice requirement cannot be met, the committee, subcommittee, or division shall give simultaneous notice to all known proponents and opponents of the bill as soon as practicable. And so that clearly was done. That second part of, or it's the last line of the rule. That was clearly done. So I think looking at the equities and then the phrase to the extent practical would certainly allow for the hearing to proceed this morning. So,
Mr. Chair.
Sir Fishback.
Mr. Chair, right. I just wanted to go back. You kept using the word expectation. There was an expectation, and I didn't take notes, so forgive me, Mr. Chair, but you said something to the effect of there was an expectation that this bill would be heard today. And
yes.
I guess I was unaware of any kind of expectation until 6:45 last night. I had not heard that it was going to be heard. And I guess maybe in your office, as you were planning on it, but you didn't tell anybody else, or at least members of the committee that I have spoken with, that there was any idea that this would be heard today until 6:45 last night.
Senator Fishbach, I guess maybe what I was referring to is I spoke to several opponents previously and said that I expected the bill to be heard this morning. And I guess, to be fair, I did not speak to individual committee members. But certainly I'll make the same offer. I'm sorry, Senator Fishbach.
But Mr. Chair, if there was an expectation, why didn't you at least have it posted? You could have had the 3 days' notice then, and it's easier to pull a bill off than it is to add it in less than 14 hours beforehand.
Fair criticism. I offered the reasons and the rationales for proceeding. I will certainly indicate to members of the committee, whether supporters or opponents, members of the committee, that if there are constituents of yours who intend to testify, let me know during the course of the day. If you've heard from constituents who have expressed an interest in coming from wherever they might be coming, St. Louis Park or Hutchinson or St. Cloud or Winona or Thief River or, Hibbing, and they'd like to be here, we will certainly make sure they're here. So, Senator Pappas, why don't
Thank
we proceed
you.
With your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to keep my comments brief so that the testifiers, we be sure we include the testifiers who signed up. Given the weather conditions, they may not be able to stay or return. And out of courtesy to them, we'll try to move quickly. Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 778 is simply a law that would allow two groups of workers, family daycare providers and personal care attendants, to organize under Chapter 179A, the Public Employment Relations Act, known as PELRA, if they wish to. It would be their choice. This is about democracy. This is about being able to decide if you want to organize or not. As the First Amendment says, you have the right to petition your government for a redress of grievances. And that's what unions, that's what associations, that's what organizations do, is they organize to advance themselves as workers or the goals of their organization. Our goals for service recipients is accessible care, quality, and stability. And our goals for service providers are fair wages and access to training. The Article 1 of the bill, called the Child Care Collective Bargaining Act, would give child care providers the right to choose whether or not to have a union and to bargain collectively with the state on issues that affect their work. The legislation affects all licensed and unlicensed home-based providers who receive, only those who receive, state subsidies from Child Care Assistance Program. And there are currently about 11,000 of these providers in Minnesota. 16 other states recognize the right of child care providers to bargain collectively with the state and have a voice in decisions that affect their work. Union child care providers have helped other states improve training, increase quality and affordability for parents, provide more consistent care with less turnover, and ensure on-time payments for providers. The health of our economy depends in part on working families having high-quality, affordable, and dependable child care, so parents can go to work with peace of mind knowing their kids are healthy, learning, and safe. Child care providers will engage in collective bargaining if 30% sign cards triggering a union election, and then 50% plus one of those voting in the union election would determine if there was to be a union or not. This is the same way that teachers and nurses have organized across the state for decades, and this is the same threshold for every other group of workers who have unionized in Minnesota. Briefly, Section 2 about our home care workers. These are the people who take care of our family members. They're the direct support workers who care for seniors and people with disabilities in their homes. These workers provide critical services that allow the elderly and people with disabilities to live at home with their families or independently in the community. The bill is about ensuring accessible quality care to Minnesotans throughout all stages of life by committing ourselves to workforce development in our long-term care system. We face a looming workforce crisis in our public home care programs, providing direct support services for seniors and people with disabilities. As demographics shift and the need for these services increases, there will not be enough workers to fill this need due to low wages, part-time hours, and a lack of benefits or training opportunities. To accomplish this, we must strengthen the workforce of our care system and our state-funded home care programs, and expand opportunities for people to direct their own services in this program. The main provision in this bill is the creation of a Department of Human Services list of home care workers for possible representation purposes. This is the list of those home care workers in self-directed programs where the client selects, hires, directs, and can terminate the employment of their specific home care worker or workers. The bill does not affect those workers who are hired directly by private agencies. In order to, as I said, stabilize the home care workforce, which sees as much as a 50% turnover in a given year, and to attract more people into a field with growing demand as our state ages, this bill would allow workers to choose to form a union, and if they did so, to bargain with the state over wages and benefits. Could the page get me some water, please? This requires that DHS create a list of workers for use by an exclusive representative to facilitate the representation process. That's the major expense in the bill. And this workforce is different from many others in that there's no single place of work, and that place of work is explicitly the home of their client receiving services through medical assistance. As a result, the list created would be of home care workers in self-directed programs, along with their home addresses to protect the private data of their clients. The list will allow the workers, through their exclusive representative, to speak with fellow home care workers about their common interests and potential interests in forming a union. Mr. Chairman, I do have some technical amendments, but at your pleasure, we could take the testimony or we could have Mr. Nauman go over the fiscal sheet.
Well, look, why don't we have folks who have asked to testify? You've gone through the bill. Let's do things as we normally do. Let's have – I mean, we do have testimony, we usually do that before amendments. So I've got a number of people who've asked to testify, and I think these are opponents. And because a lot of people are interested, as has been indicated, this is a bill of some controversy, so I'll ask if there are other folks who wish to offer some testimony. But the ones who have made the request, first Amanda Durr and Cara Benson.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to bring up panels and I can step aside?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
This is Sarah Fishbach.
May I just make the suggestion that maybe some of the folks that came from out of town be asked to go first because with between weather and the fact that, you know, they may not be able to come back or not.
Sarah Fishbach, I was going to okay, that's not unfair. Let me
because I did, Mr. Chair, get a note, and there was someone from St. Cloud, someone from Zimmerman, and I'm not sure there was another name that I
okay.
got.
We're going to hear their testimony this morning for sure. Let me start out with Ms. Durr and Ms. Benson because I think they represent are going to offer some testimony on behalf of an association. Let me start with them and then. If you could identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Durr, and I'm here representing AccraCare, a PCA provider agency that employs over 2,600 PCAs that would be affected by this legislation. AccraCare opposes this legislation for a number of reasons. First, many of the talking points behind this bill say that it only applies to PCAs that are independent contractors. That's inaccurate. Under Minnesota Statute 256B, 0.0659, a PCA under the PCA Choice Program is required to be employed by an agency. Though the program is designed to be flexible and allow the program recipient to choose their own caregiver and provide their own client-specific training in their home environment, these PCA services are organized by AccraCare. AccraCare goes in and sets up a care plan and provides basic employee training such as basic first aid, vulnerable adult, and maltreatment of minors. AccraCare also covers the employee's workers' comp, keeps track of the PCA's hours, and reports them to the state, and receives the MA payments from the state to pay the employee's wage. The W-2 for these employees is from AccraCare. AccraCare's PCAs, as private employees, are already eligible to be organized by any employee union. Unfortunately, this proposal provides a runaround to organize the state's entire PCA workforce, which is approximately 31,000 providers, by turning them into public employees for the sole purpose of organization. Under this proposal, AccraCare employees could be unionized even if not a single one voted in favor of the election. Secondly, even if the state's PCA workforce elected union representation, would organization have any positive effect on PCA wages? Unlike other state employee unions, whose contracts are negotiated within the confines of the state budget, PCA payment rates are set in statute. Even if the union negotiated a contract with MMB, it would not be binding upon the legislature. The Health and Human Services Budget Division could still pass any budget and reimbursement rate it desired. Finally, this bill would limit the flexibility of consumer direct community support waiver services. Under this program, participants can allocate their waiver funds in the best way that meets their care needs. Oftentimes, a participant hires a professional caregiver for the daytime hours but may pay a family member minimum wage to stay with them in the evening. Mandating a flat wage would limit the hours of care these participants could receive and potentially result in switching to a more expensive traditional waiver services. This self-direction model is proven to save the state around 30%, so movement away from this model could result in significant cost increases for the state. For these and several other reasons, we ask you to please oppose this legislation. I'll now turn it over to Kara Benson, who is a program director with AccraCare.
Ms. Benson, if you could please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Westrom.
I just ask if they could be a little closer to the microphone. I could hear, but I think it would be louder if they would get closer to the microphone.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Benson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kara Benson. I'm a program director at AccraCare. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. AccraCare is opposed to this bill because there are too many questions and not enough answers. First, I would like to express my disappointment that this bill did not receive a hearing in Health and Human Services Finance Division. This proposal has sweeping implications, both policy and financial, to Minnesota's home care provider system and self-directed services. How this bill would affect provider agencies, employees, and the Department of Human Services oversight deserves a thorough public review and discussion. This bill also establishes future ongoing costs upon the Department of Human Services. The committee with jurisdiction over this budget should be discussing how those will be funded. As it currently stands, AccraCare is uncertain as to what the enactment of this legislation means for our business model. The state requires PCA choice providers to be the employer of an agency like AccraCare. Yet, this bill dismisses that employee-employer relationship and would consider our employees as public for the sole purpose of union organization. Is the state moving away from self-directed care and consumer choice? Further, this proposal seemingly adds significant additional duties to the provider agencies to assist in unionization effort. Collecting the names and collecting information about our providers and giving them to DHS, withholding union dues from their paychecks, and new employee training mandates. Will we receive funding from the state to administer these functions, or would we be expected to absorb those additional costs? with PCA rates being predicated in the legislature's budget and the potential for mandate wage rates required through a union contract, we can only assume that several provider agencies would no longer be able to operate. I fear the availability of those consumer-directed services, which provides the state with significant cost savings, would greatly decline if this bill were to be enacted into law. Finally, it is worth noting that should union dues be collected at the same rate as other states with organized PCA workforce, Minnesota's 31,000 PCAs would generate about $8 million in union dues each year. That is $8 million in taxpayer MA dollars that would be diverted from caring for individuals that are elderly or disabled in union coffers. I ask this committee to please pause and consider the implications of passing this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for the witnesses? Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just real quickly, one question. How much would the union dues be estimated if this were to go forward?
Estimated at $8 million.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Miller.
Thank you. Is that, to the testifier, is that $8 million annually?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Relative to Senator Fischbach's suggestion, the other names I have are Ann Ripka, Barb Drexler, Luzum, Marie Rivard, Christine Novotny, and Terry Bierman. Apparently some of those folks are from out of town, so maybe we could ask whoever's from out of town to come to the witness table, if they're out of town people here. Okay. So. Again, we'll have a chance to hear everybody. So, welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Am I going now?
Certainly. Thanks for coming.
So distracted.
Sure.
Thank you for letting me come and talk today. My name is Barb Drexler Luzum, and you've heard my children in here and out of here, and I am coming to represent the family. This is my life. This bill that you guys are talking about, this is my life. I live it every day. Never in a million years thought I would be here testifying for you for this, the opposition of this bill. It's just where I am, and sad to say, it could happen to anybody at any time. So you kind of have to be careful with these bills because they really do hit home for some people. My daughter was born missing just a small part of a chromosome. I keep saying to my husband, what do the other chromosomes do? So, because she's severely handicapped, just missing a part of that. And we have been on the CDCS budget since 2001 when I had my third child, and the social worker said, you got to get help for your daughter. I think they could see before I could what her handicaps were going to mean for my family. So I have had to do a lot of advocating for her, and I won't stop just because it's important, and I think people need to see what it's really like inside the doors of my home. And when you pass this a bill for unionizing, you're actually unionizing my personal home, and you're regulating my house. And I'm on the consumer-directed community supports plan, and that has worked so well for my family because I don't know if any of you have had to put your children in daycare, but, and I don't know about the women and their men, I'm sorry, but we just have this mom's instinct of what feels really right for your child. And the same goes with your caregivers, almost more so, especially when you have caregivers that can't communicate what's going on, or not caregivers, children that can't communicate what's going on. You really need to feel, and you need to hire, and you need to, I'm going to be interviewing my own people no matter what. I'm not going to let an agency do that for my child. I train my own PCAs. They come in my home. They shadow. I have the process that I go through is I hire them from people that I know and trust. They come in. I introduce them to Ellie. You know, she pulls their hair. She laughs at them. She does what she does. And then I say, you know what? You need to go home and think about this because this is a really big job. And I don't want an answer from you today. Just come back because she is not potty trained yet. And I don't know if she ever will be. And it's just, you know, she throws up and she drools and it's not pretty. And you just really need people that you know can handle that and don't, I don't know, just don't shun at things like that because this is my child. And so it's very personal. And so I hire them. I have them come and I meet her. She sees the whole family. And now, you know, when the kids were really little, it was kind of crazy because my PCAs, my other children would go to them because they were adults in the household. And so they would go to the, hey, can I have a cookie? I'm like, I just said no, you know. So it's just a crazy thing. And I pay my PCAs about $12.50 an hour. I have looked into an agency in the past, just thinking it might be easier to always have, just to have something solid back there instead of trying to find my own. And I'd have to pay them double. And right now, my budget, I use 90 to 95% of my budget on PCAs every year because I need them 11 hours a day in the summer. The only reason I don't need one at night is because we have a special bed that she can go in. Otherwise, I would need nightly care as well. Let's see, what else did I want to say? So I screen, I train, I'm in control because she's mine and it's my family and I just really need to have a say in that. And I really would not like to have a union come in and tell me the things that I can and cannot do. The LifeWorks, the organization that I go through, they have a screening process. They have a handbook. You know, I have a social worker through the state that comes out and sets my budget with me. So it's all very well controlled, but at the same time, I have some freedom and some choice in a situation that I didn't have a choice to get in the first place. So, and one thing I'd like to say, too, is that my PCAs stay for a long time. I have some that started at 16 and still come, and they're 25. And they'll still come, and, oh, I want to get a weekend in with her, and I want to, you know, and they love her. And that is, like, the most important thing to me.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And let me just indicate, before we take next person, I'm guessing the people I have on the list to testify are individuals who normally don't show up here. So you don't have to apologize. Just delighted to hear have your testimony. This is nothing. There's a degree of formality, but only a degree. So we're more concerned about listening to you, and don't worry about the formalities of testimony. So just pleased to have you here.
Oh, so, thank you so much. My one son is really happy because he got to skip school because he forgot his math homework. So I've got that going on, too.
Does he need a written excuse from the chairman? But So if you could just identify yourself, and happy to listen to you.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. Sorry, I'm a little hoarse, have a cold. My name's Christine Novotny. I live in Zimmerman, Minnesota, of course. In 2005, I became an employee for my son under the Consumer Directed Community Support Program. The program, of course, allowed me to hire, train, and supervise the personal care assistants who cared for him, including myself. Jordan will soon be 17 years old and has cerebral palsy. He is wheelchair-bound and has a profound developmental delays. He will require total and complete support for the remainder of his life. He does not understand what a union is or how it affects him. I'm in front of you today to give him a voice. A all recipients and their guardians want the same things. They want competent, trustworthy, excuse me, and caring personal care assistance, which results in a high quality of care and ensures his health and safety needs are met on a daily basis. My son already receives a high quality of care because I hire trusted family members and friends who are familiar with his needs and his personality. When I am not hiring a friend or a family member, I hire only those who have the experience and training that would make them a successful candidate with Jordan and with our family. Those who work for Jordan, including myself and Jordan as well, are already covered by health insurance or have access to health care. Currently, a friend who works for Jordan not only has a full-time job, but the wage I offer her and all previous employees is the same, if not above, some of the local health care agencies. As Jordan grows older and requires more employees to support his needs, the changes that the proposed bill would require will have an even greater impact as they do now. Please remember his needs and give him a voice when casting your vote. And I just wanted to make a mention as well about budget-related issues, because that's certainly a concern here. Like many people today, including the state of Minnesota, I live or have to live within a budget. I'm assigned a certain amount of dollars every year, and I have to do weigh what is important that year with what I need to do on any given year. So sometimes that changes. The money has to cover workman's compensation, Social Security, respite care for myself and my husband, adaptation to his home, our home, and many other items that improve the quality of his life and give him greater control over his environment. So I just want to reiterate that the budget-related issue is an important one, and we have to make really hard decisions sometimes, and those additional costs related to unionization will have a great impact on his life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. And recognize that for any parent, you know, nothing's more important than children, particularly where you are wrestling with some of these issues that accentuates that. So appreciate your being here. So if you could identify yourself, and happy to listen to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Terry Bierman from St. Cloud, Minnesota. I do have written copies of my testimony if anyone would be interested in those today.
If we could have the pages, get that.
Okay. As a CDCS worker, I'm here today because I'm very concerned about unionization of my family. Our daughter Maren was born on October 23rd, 1998, with nines on both of her APGARs. We thought things were going to be great. Then 17 and a half hours later, our lives took a detour we never imagined or saw coming. By the time she was 3.5 years old, we were told, 3.5 months old, we were told to put her in an institution because she wasn't going to live to see the age of two. She's now 14 years old, nearly 15. And so from the very beginning, we were committed that we wanted to give her the best quality of life possible because quantity was not a guarantee. Life was challenging those first 7 years. We were in and out of the hospital more times than I could count. We lost count at about 50 hospitalizations. We were in so often that I had to resign my teaching career. We also seemed to have a continual flow of staff coming into and out of our home. It seemed like we were constantly training in new staff, only to have them move up to a supervisory position or take a position in a clinic or a hospital with higher pay. We were frequently without staff and running the whole show by ourselves. Our daughter receives medications and treatments from 7 a.m. until midnight, and that's on a good day. When she's ill, our days begin at 2 a.m. She requires a highly specialized diet via G-tube, numerous medications, respiratory interventions, infusion therapies biweekly. She's nonverbal, nonmobile, and incontinent. CDCS did not become available to us in Stearns County until November of 2005. We were finally able to pay our staff a wage that made them feel appreciated and allowed them to stay in our home and support their families. We've had a total of 8 staff in our home since November 20th, 2005, and 5 of them are still with us today. We, like most families, left the traditional agency because we felt that we could determine wages, benefits, and staffing directly with our people, minimizing the stress and miscommunication we often experienced with the 5 traditional agencies that we had used. By taking on those responsibilities, we were able to pass those dollars on to our staff in the form of setting wages and training to include CPR, first aid, and any relevant trainings to my daughter's cares, medical equipment, augmented communication, or any of those things that we use on a daily basis to support her quality of life. In the current model, we can negotiate wage and benefits on a case-by-case basis, based on job requirements, based on expectations. And sometimes a lesser wage is appropriate, especially in the situation when grandma is coming to stay for a weekend. In a unionized model, we would lose those options and reopen the revolving door of staff. For my daughter, the key to unlocking her potential has been continuity of care. It greatly reduced hospitalizations and allowed us to focus on her potential and quality of life. If we were to lose our core principles of self-direction, establishing wages and benefits and training requirements, there wouldn't be much point in staying on the CDCS model. If we returned to traditional services, our utilization would increase beyond our CDCS budget by at least 30%, and that's not allowed in your fiscal note. If forced unionization passes, I'm sure a high percentage of families would have to make that same decision. CDCS works. It keeps families together, pays staff fairly, and allows for flexibility in services and providers. CDCS is a lifeline for families who are willing to take on the additional responsibilities for organizing care for their loved one in their homes. I strongly urge the protection of self-direction under this model. We have chosen the most cost-effective method of meeting our child's needs for the last 7.5 years, and further reductions and or burdening CDCS with the expense of a union puts her services and the services of so many others in jeopardy. Thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony and for both you and Ms. Novotny that you came some distance to testify. I appreciate it. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, and I guess just a brief comment and maybe feedback from the testifiers. The last testifier, did you say you were from you were a teacher prior and you've quit your job?
I had to quit my job when
I
had to quit my job when she was 3.5 months old. I could no longer teach English and guarantee that the research papers would be returned to my students in the same term that they were submitted.
Okay.
what for you the cost part of your concern is what with the unionization the
my
dues that would be charged to
dues.
You if you had to join and the fair share
lack
if you didn't have to join
lack of flexibility really the only people in our home that would be eligible for the union are my husband and myself. And so you are truly unionizing our family because we would choose to care for our daughter in our home. And if you put me and my husband on a list with our addresses as PCAs, you're also putting my daughter's private information on that list. And that's something I do not want to happen. And the cost for me, I spent 6.5 years at home without having any income. I spent that 6.5 years with foreclosure knocking on our door. I had people coming to see if we were going to make our van payment. We fell behind in our house payment. And so we needed CDCS to stay together as a family. We were at a breaking point. Senator Fischbach, you saw me testify when we were at that breaking point.
And Mr. Chair, and to that point, the issue being if you didn't have to take the state subsidy or the reimbursement for some or all of the expense, you wouldn't be forced to or be subject to a potential union under this bill. But as you've demonstrated, your situation is the state is a partner and a hand up in what you're trying to do as an independent family, as an independent mm-hmm. person taking care of your precious gift from God.
Yes.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. The other two people listed, we have listed who've requested to testify, Ann Ripka and Marie Rivard, if they're present.
I am Marie Rivard. Hello, thank you for hearing me today.
Thanks for coming.
I would like to speak on behalf of my daughter, myself, and all the disabled and handicapped individuals who cannot speak for themselves today, who are in the self-directed care program. Angel is 31 years old. 8 years ago, she came down with a rare brain disease right after she graduated from college. It is gives stroke-like activity. It's called Susak syndrome. There are only 204 young girls in the U.S. or in the world that have it. Mayo Clinic is doing the leading research on the disease. It's a branch retinal artery occlusion. It attacks the arteries in the eyes, the ears, and the brain. I have had to obtain legal guardianship over Angel, and she lives with me. I am basically her only daily caretaker. Luckily, I have a lot of support from my two other daughters, Angel's father, who doesn't live around here, but he supports when he can. Angel's health has benefited tremendously with being able to utilize the self-directed benefits. Without the CDCS care, after Medicare got done paying for all of her physical therapy at the onset of her disease, she would be in a wheelchair living in a group home right now or in a nursing home because I would not be able to care for her myself. Her father would not be able to. None of my family members would be able to. The CDCS waiver has allowed her to continue her therapies where Medicare cut off. 4 years ago, she wasn't able to walk. I know you've seen her, but now she's in a walker. She has a brace for each leg. She goes to the Courage Center three times a week for hot pool therapy, and that has allowed her the spasticity in her legs to become much better. She's become much stronger. The health benefits that she's been able to utilize through the self-directed care have been unbelievable for her. She right now uses physical therapy, pool therapy, deep tissue massage therapy, metromobility, PCA care, which is me, adaptive yoga, and Weight Watchers. Without all of this therapy, Angel would not be able to walk. The ability to self-direct her own care is imperative in her situation. She benefits most from this package compared to any other package they offered us. However, she needs to be able to utilize all of her funds. All of these therapies all go together. If I were to have to forfeit any one of these, I don't know which one I could choose. They all work together for her. Obviously, Angel, along with other individuals who have issues like hers, needs some sort of physical therapy, exercise programs, community programs to support her and become healthier and to get her out into the community. Angel's aren't obviously as physical as others' people's. She's got more of a cognitive difficulties. She becomes psychotic at some points because the stroke activity was rolling strokes in her brain. So hers aren't so much that you can see with the eye. Hers are in other ways. So her PCA care is 24 hours a day. If us PCAs are forced to join a union that will take money away from her already low budget that I have to care for her because of the fact that it is more of a mental disability in her right now than it is a physical, even though obviously you've seen it as a physical disability. Self-directed care means just that. It's self-directed. I would have to join a union. I would have to pay myself so much. So little. I give her 24-hour care as it is. I guess I hope that I have given you a little perspective on the situation. Please realize that if other disabled individuals could be here to speak, I'm sure you'd have a building full. I, too, also got the notice at 8:30 last night that I had to be here. I have a full-time job. Angel was supposed to be at the Courage Center this morning at 8 o'clock. We had to cancel her MetroMobility ride. She gets demerits for canceling it so late at night. We've changed our whole schedule today to do this. So I guess if we can be here, then maybe other people can step up to the plate and try to be here also.
Thank you, Ms. Rivard.
I do have another affidavit from my daughter who couldn't be here, and then mine. Who shall I give this to?
If you can give it to one of the pages, we'd be happy to make copies and distribute that.
Thank you.
Okay. And then is it Ms. Rupka?
Thank you. Ann couldn't be here, so they said I could come up and testify.
Certainly.
I don't know if I will be able to be as eloquent.
Thank you. Just go ahead, and if you could just identify yourself.
Sure. My name is Angela Berger, and my daughter's name is Sunny. She's 10 years old, and we are in the PCA Choice Program, a program that's offered by LifeWorks, which is similar to AcroCare. In that program, we've hired someone who's been with us for 8 years in our family. So our PCA has been in our home for 8 years, a very stable relationship with her. She does not wish, and I do not wish, to put a union in between that relationship. Right now, she's considered an employee of myself and of LifeWorks. She's not a public employee, which this bill would try to make her a public employee. There's a lot of situations that unions can fit into, and a lot of situations that union membership works well for people. I just don't believe that this is one of them. And I wish that you would give this some more time to really look at how this is going to affect families and the human services programs that you've set up, and just give it another session to think about it. When my daughter's 18 in 8 years, I would be eligible to take care of her as a PCA, and if there's a union, then I would need to join that union. When Sunny's twin sister in 6 years is 16, she would be eligible to be paid as a PCA for her. So my 16-year-old would need to join a union. I know that you think ultimately that this could help the funding and the reimbursement rates for PCAs, and I understand the true reason that you think this would be helpful, but there's a lot of disagreement on that and of how this money would actually flow and where it would end up. And as Kara had mentioned, the dues that would come out of the paychecks of the PCAs and the other expenses that are in the fiscal notes for the human services budget, you know, that money really needs to stay and go directly to the disabled and their families. Every dollar of that is needed. Again, if you could consider just delaying this and thinking about it a little bit, I know you have the votes in this committee. I know you have the votes on the floor. But just because you can do it, please think about waiting on it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for being here. Members, I think session has probably about to begin, but I wanted to find out if there's anybody else, particularly people from out of town, who would like to testify. Okay, was there somebody? Sure. Come on forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Well, while she's coming, can I just ask what you foresee the schedule being? I've heard talk about this afternoon, tonight, tomorrow. At one point, I heard you just about make maybe a Freudian slip, but I won't assert that. You can affirm or deny it. But you even said we won't finish this. And then you stopped. I think the final word you were going to say was today, but you didn't stop short of saying that. And the reason I'm asking is I have heard from even a local newspaper in my district that has been following this issue a lot and very concerned about people in western Minnesota, and we talk about Thief River Falls. You could hardly get down here from Thief River Falls even for a hearing tonight That's assuming you could drop everything that you have scheduled. And so I'm wondering if there's an opportunity to at least continue this going into Monday, which gives us the whole week, or for those of us in rural Minnesota especially, should we clear and reorganize everything that we might have going on tonight or tomorrow or in our districts? Because I wasn't aware of this large topic coming up Friday morning when I was anticipating the weekend.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Wistrom. And now you've kind of covered the waterfront. Let me make it easy for you. When we finish the testimony, we'll take the bill back up on Monday morning. So we had someone else who wished to testify. I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wistrom. I thank you. I'm sure it was my persuasion that just made you make that decision.
Well, it wasn't your persuasion. I just felt very, very sorry for you.
whatever works, Mr. Chair.
So I was trying to be sympathetic.
No, thank you for that.
Thank you, Dory. Okay, we have session waiting for us. I know. All right. So was there anybody else who wished to testify? Okay, if not, I don't see any other hands up, I hope. Except for Senator Enos.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe we can avoid Monday. I'm going to make my motion. I'll move Senate File 778 be referred back down to the HHS division for their expert review.
All right. We have Senator Enos' motion in front of us. Let me indicate if his motion passes. I will quite likely still pull the bill back from division. But what I will do, Senator Enos, if your motion passes, is I'll consult with Senator Lori, who's not here, and get his directive or wishes relative to that. So on Senator Enos' motion, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify, regardless of what I how I feel about the bill or don't feel about the bill, I'm not one to go against my finance chair. So.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that admonition, did everybody note that?
Mr. Chair, I have no problem going against the finance chair.
Yeah, I've noticed that. And relative to what Senator Peterson said, I've been taking notes, too. But go ahead, Senator Fishbein.
But, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand your strong opposition to allowing Health and Human Services look at this.
Senator Fishbein, we got Senator Nino's motion. I said I would consult with Senator Lori, who chairs the division.
But, Mr. Chair, you also said you within, I think, did you even give a time? Within 30 seconds you were going to pull it back at one point, I think you said. Yeah.
I'm not going to pull it back within 30 seconds. I'll talk to Senator Lori on the floor.
Within 30 minutes? I mean, can I, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm really struggling with like I said, your strong opposition to having Health and Human Services take a look at this, because if you just glance at the first page of the fiscal note, you know, Human Services is talking about adding 12 FTEs, and I don't understand why Health and Human wouldn't want to see it.
And I don't understand that issue either. I intend to question Human Services in a significant way, and in fact, the delay will allow Mr. Nauman to do some further work, and it will allow Human Services to talk to me during the course of the session. You're absolutely correct.
So, Mr. Chair, you're keeping an open mind.
That is correct.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Enos' motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion fails.
Division.
Division has been requested. All those in favor of Senator Enos' motion, please raise your hand. Senator Anderson.
They say if you don't try, anyway. You got two up, too.
All right. All right. All those opposed, raise your hand. Only one per person.
Say if you don't try.
Here, let me on a vote of 9-9, motion fails. All right. So. Committee is adjourned for the day, Senator Westrum, and we'll be back Monday morning at 8:30. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Picking this up Monday morning? Do you want everything else on the agenda?
No, we are.
Okay. Let's go on the floor.
Now, we adjourned, right? We're done?
Yes. Yeah. We're adjourned.
You're done with me,
yeah?
Okay.
Okay with me. I know. Well, that's my word right now. My
Right, walk in when you can.
So,